This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, veterans at Western Michigan University will share their stories as part of events at WMU to mark Veterans Day. WMUK's Andy Robbins spoke with one student who's written about his time in the Marines. But first, what are the things that make up a good economic development strategy? Upjohn Institute economist Tim Bartik has been arguing for years that investing in high-quality preschool is a good investment in education as well as in economic development. Bartik is the author of a new book on the subject, From Preschool to Prosperity, The Economic Payoff to Early Childhood Education. Tim Bartik, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin with the basic question that almost every author gets asked when they put out a book. Why a book? And of course, in your case, why another book on a subject that you've already written extensively about?
I want to write another book in part because I wanted to write a book that was more accessible to a general audience. This book is a lot shorter than my 2011 book. It can be read in an hour and a half. It's available free on the Upjohn Institute website. So we wanted a book that was very accessible. And of course, the other thing is there's been issues that have developed since 2011 that I wanted to address. Some pushback against preschool has occurred from some quarters. I wanted to respond to some of that. And there's been some new research I wanted to add. And so I wanted to basically write a book that would address the key issues in 2014 in a way that was very accessible to as many readers as possible.
Broadly speaking, what does the research show about high-quality preschool and the benefits down the road for those children who partake in it?
Well, what the research shows is that not only does preschool prepare kids better for kindergarten, and we see that from a wide variety of research studies, but it improves adult outcomes. Employment rates go up, earnings goes up. As a result, you're going to have people paying more money in taxes, and so there's going to be a better fiscal situation for the government, you know, receiving less money in welfare. There's less crime. And there are important spillover benefits for the overall economy. One of the things I emphasize that not only do the participants in preschool benefit, but building up skills has spillover benefits for the whole economy, that my wages will be higher if other people have higher skills. And why is that? Because if my coworkers have higher skills, my employer is going to be better able to introduce new technologies. Isn't it? You know, you can't be competitive as an employer of just a few workers at a workplace who are skilled. You need to have everyone be skilled. So everyone has a stake in making sure that all kids have high skills. Now, preschool is not the only way to do that. Obviously, there are things we do in the K-12 system and in the higher education system that affect skills. So I'm not claiming that preschool solves all the problems, but it is one of the areas that we know from research has one of the highest bang for the buck for any kind of investment we might want to make in skills development.
As you noted, there's been some pushback. Some people have questioned some of the research. You have a cartoon in here, which illustrates the point that I've heard you make before, which is we can say more definitively that high-quality preschool works than we can say third grade works. And that's because we have a control. I mean, everybody goes to third grade, but not everybody goes to preschool. That's how we can do that research a little better, right?
Right. And we have both random assignment experiments where we flipped a coin and said to some kids, you're not going to go to preschool, which obviously we can't do with third grade or with many other school programs. And we also have some natural experiments where preschool access has varied for reasons that have nothing to do with other factors that might affect success. Yeah, there's been some pushback. I mean, obviously, as you try to expand something, there are always going to be skeptics out there or people who are concerned about the money, legitimate concerns. I mean, anytime you make an investment, you need to make sure it pays off. I want to emphasize, though, I think it's a broad consensus of the research literature that preschool works. So it's not just me saying it or a few researchers. This is the broad consensus of most researchers on the topic. The pushback comes from a few researchers who have taken a position that, yes, preschool works in some places, but maybe it doesn't work on a large scale. And on the whole, I think the research evidence, though, shows that preschool does work on a large scale. We've seen success, for example, in Tulsa and Boston and Chicago, where we have large-scale programs run by typical public school agencies in those cities.
But the two things you bring up there, I suppose, lead to kind of the next question. Those two things being, one, questions about how well it works broadly, and two, as you say, questions about how much money to spend, which I guess leads us to, is it better to perhaps target programs for economically disadvantaged families, or is it better to have a universal program which would provide preschool, perhaps publicly funded preschool, to everybody or a broad swath of the population?
Well, it's very important to have quality, and the issue, you know, there is an issue of cost. So let's talk about a couple items. First of all, how much are we talking about in terms of cost? So if we wanted to do universal preschool, that essentially would cost about 4% of what we spend on K-12 education. 4%, less than $1 compared to over $25 for K-12. And out of overall taxes, we're talking about an increase in overall federal, state, and local taxes, less than 1% of overall federal, state, and local taxes. So it is billions of dollars, but we're in a big economy. And so when you look at it in terms of either overall taxes or in terms of what we spend on K-12, it's not that much. Then there's the question of, should it just be for low-income kids or should it be for middle-class kids? Well, first, the evidence from both Tulsa and Boston is that preschool works almost as well for middle-class kids as for low-income kids. Now, why might that be the case? One, preschool is something that, on their own, parents have trouble delivering those benefits. I mean, a lot of the benefits of preschool is kids learning soft skills, social skills, things like how to get along with the teacher, how to get along with their other students. Skills which are very important in determining adult economic success. I mean, those are the kind of skills on the workplace that employers are looking for. Can you get along with customers, coworkers, supervisors? So it's kind of hard for a parent on their own without some kind of preschool experience to teach those soft skills. Now, parents, of course, can use private preschool, but high-quality preschool is expensive. Full-day preschool for one school year, if it's going to be high quality, have good teachers, reasonable class sizes, costs close to $10,000 a year. Now, that's something that's hard for even middle-class parents to afford. $10,000 a year for a program that's 6 hours a day for 9 months a year, that's a pretty hefty price tag. So I think if you really want to make preschool accessible to a broad group of Americans and not just the rich, you're going to have a universal program. A universal program also has some other advantages. We know that low-income kids in particular benefit from positive peer effects if they're in income-integrated programs. I mean, if you're setting up a school, ideally you don't want it to be 100% low-income kids. I mean, not that you can't have a good school in that situation, but it's more challenging. And the positive peer effects of having income-integrated preschool are significant. There are a number of studies showing that income-integrated preschool can be more successful. And finally, I think as a practical matter, there are some political arguments that if middle class as well as low income families have a stake in the quality of the local preschool program, you're going to have a broad range of political forces that are going to push to maintain quality. So, you know, I think you could, you know, talk about targeting this if you're short of resources, if you don't have enough money to serve everyone. And I think that's a reasonable point. But I think the economic benefits are likely to be greater if we include the middle class. The peer effects are going to be better if you include the middle class. And the political pressure to maintain quality will be much better if we include all income groups, not just the poor.
Voters in Seattle approved a property tax levy on Election Day, which is going to subsidize preschool in that city. When you look at something like that on a citywide basis, do you view that as a step in the right direction? Or do you think in order for it to be fully effective, programs have to be perhaps at the state or even beyond that, a regional, federal level?
Well, I'm pretty pragmatic about it. It can happen at any level. I mean, I don't think that preschool necessarily has to be funded at the federal level. And in fact, given the stuff that's on the federal government's plate these days, dealing with healthcare, the Social Security system, defense, et cetera, I'm a little skeptical that, in fact, we're going to see a major federal government investment in preschool. So I think it has to come at the state and local level. And that's where traditionally education has been mostly funded in the U.S. And it's been a mixed responsibility. In most states, there's a mixture of local and state revenue going into this. Now, in Michigan, we're a little unusual because it's really state-dominated, but there, you know, still is some local tax revenue from property taxes that goes into schools. So I guess I would say, depending on the state, we need to have some mixture of state and local initiatives to fund this. And, you know, in the case of Seattle, they decided to move ahead. In the case of New York City, they recently have moved to universal preschool. But in other cases, Oklahoma, the whole state adopted universal preschool. Georgia, pretty much the whole state moved to universal preschool. So the situation differs quite a bit in different state and local areas.
I'm wondering if there would be some benefit to finding a certain dedicated revenue stream and saying that this is what goes to universal preschool, because I'm imagining the time when budgets start getting squeezed again, as they always seem to do, and in a downturn, when people who are having to decide what a state spends money on, they might look at high-quality preschool and say, it's nice, but it's not an essential service.
Well, I think that that is an important point. I mean, we have that in certain cases in the states that maintain this. So, for example, Georgia basically passed preschool as part of a package when they adopted a state lottery. And the lottery funded a lot of educational initiatives, including preschool. In Oklahoma, essentially what they did is they simply made a very simple change in their state school aid act. They said, rather than the State School Aid Act assisting children in public education ages 5 to 18, they changed the 5 to a 4. And then local school districts could go to their voters and ask for an increase in local property taxes. They would get considerable state aid per student for the four-year-olds. And so essentially in Oklahoma, preschool is universal in exactly the same way that kindergarten is universal. It's funded on the same basis by both school districts and the state government. So I think you need to somehow institutionalize it so it's not in some little fund secreted off somewhere that can easily be cut if times are tough.
Michigan has moved in the direction of expanding access to preschool. We've talked to you about this in the past when it has happened. Where does Michigan start to measure up now in terms of what other states are doing? Are we middle of the pack, better than that?
Well, we've had a very good expansion. So basically, Michigan 2 years ago had about 21%, one in five, of Michigan four-year-olds were in the state-funded preschool program. As of today, that's expanded to about 33%, one in three. So from one in five to one in three. That's a significant increase. Now, in terms of the national average is about 28%. So we've moved from below the national average to above the national average. On the other hand, in terms of access, we're still behind the leading states. In Oklahoma, which I've mentioned several times, because they have a very good universal preschool program, which surprises people given the stereotype.
Conservative nature of the state.
Very conservative state. About 75%. Of four-year-olds in Oklahoma are in state-funded preschool. So essentially, they have universal access. When you combine that with Head Start, which is another 10 or 15% of students, that's about 90%. And then there's some private preschools, and some parents, of course, choose not to have their kid in preschool. It's voluntary. Universal doesn't mean compulsory. It just means universal access. So Oklahoma, you know, is a leading state, and there are another seven or eight states that have more than 50% of their four-year-olds in state-funded preschool. So Michigan is still well behind those states in access. And the other concern I have about the expansion is I have concerns about whether or not, as we're expanding the program, are we doing enough to maintain the quality. I mean, Michigan's program has been rated high for quality in the past. There are some very good studies showing that the program has strong effects, not just on kindergarten readiness, but on school dropouts, school performance, and a variety of indicators. So Michigan has had a good program, but the program used to be a lot better funded per student. I mentioned you need close to $5,000 per half-day slot, $4,500, $5,000 per half-day slot. Michigan's program is currently below $4,000 per half-day slot. And in the past, in the 1990s, if you adjust for inflation, we were more in the range of the funding level you would need. So I have some concerns about whether we have enough funding to attract and retain quality teachers on a consistent basis in the program, especially as we expand it. And I also think that as we expand the program, we need to be doing more in terms of support service. I mentioned teacher coaching. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the most effective way of upgrading the quality of teaching is to have very good teachers work one-on-one in the classroom with new teachers or with teachers, any teachers who need some assistance in improving. And I think the state should be investing more funds in that. Now, I should say in Kalamazoo, I mean, I serve on the board of an organization, KC Ready Fours, that in fact provides such teacher coaching. I mean, so it's something I believe in, and it's something that is a very valuable service to help upgrade preschool quality.
Will those benefits of high-quality preschool that you've talked about diminish over time if there is not also quality K-12 schooling and then quality higher education beyond that?
Oh, I think there's a synergy between all this. So I think that, you know, none of this, arguing for preschool is not arguing that we should disinvest in K-12 or in higher education. In fact, there's some evidence that there's a synergy, that the rate of return to investing in preschool is higher if you invest in K-12 and vice versa. However, I should mention that even when the K-12 system has problems, that investing in preschool can pay off. So, for example, I mentioned that one of the really good studies of high-quality preschool is of Chicago's Child Parent Center program, which is a preschool program. And that program showed that it increased adult earnings by about 8%, even though 100% of its participants went on to go through their K-12 experience in Chicago Public Schools. Now, with all due respect to Chicago Public Schools, I think the school system has a lot of challenges, and no one would claim they've solved all their problems. So even when you're in a urban school district with challenges, preschool by itself can make a big difference. Of course, it would make an even bigger difference if we simultaneously had more high-quality preschool and also improved the K-12 system.
I want to talk a little bit more about the spillover benefits that you write about in this book. And I think there may be some people who think that, well, it's all well and good to send people to high-quality preschool, but if we're in an economically depressed area, at the end of their schooling, someone's going to come out and there's only going to be so many jobs available. You make kind of a counter-argument to that.
Well, the counter-argument is, contrary to what people think, people don't all leave the area. Most of the studies show that 60% or more of the people who spend their early childhood in a state will stay in that same state as adults. And that percentage, by the way, is no lower for Michigan than for other states. I mean, it is true we have slow population growth, but that's mostly due to lower in-migration than to higher rates of out-migration of people who spent their early childhood here.
So the idea that most people will stay in the state where they grew up is pretty broad across the states regardless.
Just about every state. Obviously, some very small states, Rhode Island's a little smaller, Wyoming's a little smaller, you know, but it doesn't vary as much as you might think across the country. And so if you invest in preschool, 60% or so will stay in the state. And what does having a lot more people with skills do to an economy? It encourages companies to locate there. It encourages companies to expand. It means that companies that are in the area are more competitive, more productive, which means they can afford to pay higher wages. So there are going to be these huge spillover effects. Again, you know, so the question I ask, you know, in a cynical way, some people might say, why should I invest in other people's children? And of course, you can give ethical reasons why you should do that, but there's also an argument from enlightened self-interest. If we invest in all children, that will make the entire skill base of the state and local economy better. And that will attract and grow more jobs and better jobs. Employment rates will be higher, wage rates will be higher, and they will be higher even for people who would have been fine without any preschool. Maybe you have enough money, you can send your kid to a great private preschool. You don't need any of these publicly supported preschool programs. But your kid is going to be better off in the long run because other participants in the economy have higher skills, because that will affect the whole business climate of the area. We sometimes define business climate as just being business taxes and incentives, but it's a lot more than that. I mean, a key element of the business climate is the quality of the local labor force. That's affected by many things, but one of the most cost-effective ways of doing it is high-quality preschool.
Tim Bartik, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Tim Bartik is an economist with the Upjohn Institute in Kalamazoo. He is also the author of From Preschool to Prosperity, The Economic Payoff to Early Childhood Education. More information about Tim Bartik's book can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Western Michigan University is marking Veterans Day with an event that allows students, faculty, and staff to share their stories about military service. Western Michigan University senior Chris Hickey started his college career after serving in the Marines.
Like my father and grandfather and great-grandfather, etc., I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school back in 1991. Went to boot camp 5 days after I graduated high school, and had pretty much spent my whole adult life in the service.
Hickey is a history major, and he says the stories veterans tell are about more than the events around them. Hickey says there is a difference between a factual account and a truthful account.
The true story of war, historians will forever ponder, but the true story of war will be forever locked in the hearts and minds of those who went through it.
WMUK's Andy Robbins spoke with Chris Hickey about his writing for the event called Stories from the Barracks to the Front.
Why did you decide to get involved in this?
Well, partly I don't like to ruminate too often on my service. It's not because it's a sad or depressing thing to think about. It's contemplation takes a lot of energy, simply because. But I think in this particular event, the reason why I chose to is because just over the summer I was reading Virgil, who wrote the Aeneid, and his discussion of Aeneas leaving the underworld and him having to go through the ivory gate. And really that was a metaphor for how we remember history, not just history as a society, but how we remember history as individuals. And like all other combat veterans, or those who weren't in combat for that matter, we tend to remember things a certain way, framed by what happened afterwards or what's going on in our lives today. And that doesn't make what happened in the past necessarily factual or accurate, because remember that as an emotional experience, not a factual experience. So the particular thing I wrote about was this image of these 400 young Marines marching down the street in January of 2003. And the way I remember it is only through the prism of what happened afterwards, because about 40 of those young men are dead now over the course of their 4 years. And was I really thinking that at the time? It's impossible to say what I was thinking at the time, but I'll always remember that framed by the war that came immediately after. So it's really about memory and how we choose or chosen to remember things.
Now, that group of young men that you, young Marines that you mentioned, you saw them in the United States before?
Yes, Iraq. This was in 29 Palms, California.
And they later on went to Iraq or Afghanistan?
Yes, and I think what struck me at that time was before then I had already spent about 12 years in the service. And of course, I had served in the campaigns that I just mentioned, but I also climbed Mount Fuji and climbed Mount Vesuvius in the same year, two different parts of the world. Had a lot of fun, a lot of different adventures in the Marine Corps as a young man. But these young men, it would be very different. All they knew about the Marine Corps would be war. Of course, we didn't know that at the time. And that was my first real war, and it was obviously their first real war. And our first real war as a country, really, since Vietnam. So it was a very compelling experience. But we didn't know that at the time.
Over the years, when I've spoken to combat veterans about their experiences, they frequently have said in many different ways that When they came back, they found it difficult to talk about their experiences with, you know, their families, their friends, their, you know, their parents, who were not themselves combat veterans. Is that, do you think that's true?
That's absolutely true. And one of the things I try to tell younger guys who've been through the same things, the hardest part about wars is coming home. And really that's where the PTSD comes into play, is because you've been living at the edge of danger and excitement and this incredible adrenaline rush every single day. Every single day, you know, I remember my second tour in Iraq, every single day I would get up thinking this could be my last day. And there's this almost this pallor, a pallor of gloom that hangs over your head. And you live that way for so long, and your sense of alarm is constant throughout your time over there. And when you come home, you don't have a need for that anymore, but you don't know how to turn that off. And you're surrounded by, you know, not just family and friends, but society in general that cannot seem to understand where you're coming from. And I think over the years, especially coming here to Western, I've learned that you have to accept that. You're never going to make other people understand. And you should stop expecting that you can. And you just have to learn to incorporate that into yourself. It happened to you, and it makes you who you are today, and you have to accept that.
Do you think, though, that events like this, veterans obviously listening to other veterans, but people who are not veterans listening to the veterans like yourself speaking, is that important? And if so, why?
Well, of course it's important. Well, I mean, there's two ways to look at it. One, you can look at it from, I'm studying history, so I can look at it from a historical standpoint. It's an extremely important part of the historical record from a human standpoint, the individual experiences of those of us who have served in our country's wars. But it's also important for those in this society who have enjoyed the freedoms and the prosperity and everything, any other word you want to use to describe our society, it's important for them to understand the sacrifices that are made. The problem with that is that tends to leave an image that may not be necessarily true. Or it may not be factual, but there's a lot of truth in it. I'm not sure how to put that, because my biggest frustration is I will never be able to make other people understand, but I can at least bring them to appreciate the sacrifices that me and all the others like me had made.
Now, you mentioned that all of the participants in this event on this coming Tuesday were asked to write something down, whether it was, you know, an essay, a story, a poem, whatever, to read at this event. And you mentioned that you chose to write about that group of young Marines. Was the process of writing that, was it difficult?
Yes and no. That's obviously another complicated question. It's not hard for me to write, but it's also a very emotional experience for me to write. I mean, I was up till, I think, 2 a.m. writing that thing. It took me a couple hours. But the emotional, well, that's not an emotional toll, but it was an emotional effort to make. Because I found myself actually crying a little bit after I had written it. And it's just because it's just like you're releasing that moment in time that you had never shared with anybody else, and trying to find a way to describe this in both factual terms and emotional terms, what it actually means, because it could mean anything. But I think the important part of this is what it meant to me, and what it should mean to the audience who reads it or hears it.
Chris Hickey is a senior at Western Michigan University and veteran of the Marines. He spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins. Hickey will be among the veterans sharing their stories tomorrow as part of Veterans Day events at Western Michigan University. Links with more information can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.